On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. The nearly 19,000 people who inject drugs in the city of Baltimore often shoot up in the shadows. They even have a name for the vacant houses they sometimes use, abandominiums. Researchers at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health say that as part of a strategy to address this growing epidemic, Baltimore should establish places where addicts can use drugs more safely. Dr. Susan Sherman has written a report commissioned by the ABLE Foundation that proposes creating two safe spaces for drug use in Baltimore. She joins me today along with Robert Kinneberg, the director of the Phoenix Recovery Center, a drug treatment facility in Edgewood, and Delegate Dan Morheim, who has introduced legislation to make safe spaces for drug use permissible in Maryland. First, the news. And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Today, we're going to talk about a controversial solution being proposed for Baltimore for what everybody agrees is a very serious public health crisis, that of opioid addiction. In Baltimore City alone, it's estimated that there are nearly 25,000 people addicted to heroin and other powerful opioids. Last year, there were nearly 500 fatal IV drug overdoses in the city, a surge of 65% from 2015. For those struggling with addiction, the risk of overdose has increased dramatically as fentanyl, an incredibly dangerous drug, is mixed in with the heroin that drug users are buying on the street. The number of addicts who died from overdoses last year far surpassed those killed by homicide. Despite a range of medication-assisted treatment and addiction counseling services run by the City Health Department and both private and nonprofit organizations, most addicts still get their fixes in the shadows, in alleys, in public restrooms, or abandoned houses. They are usually alone, so if they overdose, there's no one at hand to rescue them. They often use dirty needles, which exposes them to other serious diseases. In a report published by the ABLE Foundation last week, researchers from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health proposed that the city license two safe drug consumption spaces, one in West Baltimore, one in East Baltimore, to give IV drug users a safe, sterile, and medically supervised environment in which to inject and also to give them access to addiction treatment options should they decide to try to kick their habits. Dr. Susan Sherman is one of the authors of that report, and she joins me in the studio. She's a professor in the Bloomberg School's Department of Health Behavior and Society. Dr. Sherman, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Dr. Sherman recently testified in Annapolis in support of a bill just introduced in the Maryland House by Delegate Dan Morheim that would authorize state and local authorities to license similar safe drug use spaces in communities across Maryland. We hope to be speaking with Delegate Morheim about that bill later in this hour. Robert Kinneberg joins us as well here in Studio A. He's the owner and director of the Phoenix Recovery Center, a private live-in drug and alcohol addiction treatment center located up in Edgewood, that's in Harford County. Mr. Kinneberg himself has been in successful addiction recovery for 23 years. Welcome to the show, sir.
Appreciate Thank you. Good to be here.
Great to meet you. So, Susan Sherman, how do the before we talk about how these safe spaces would work, let's talk a little bit about the scope of the problem and what currently exists to address it. There's a report by a group called the Behavioral Health Systems who give this number of about 25,000 opioid users, 19,000 of which are heroin addicts. Mm-hmm. If you're addicted to heroin or opioids, where can you currently go in the city of Baltimore?
So it depends on where can you go for what. So there are drug treatment programs in Baltimore City, abstinence-based, residential, outpatient. There are buprenorphine providers, doctors who actually prescribe something called Suboxone, which is a various, methadone is another type of opiate replacement therapy. There are a number of methadone clinics, and Suboxone you can get from a private provider, actually, unlike methadone when you need to go to a clinic. Then, of course, when you're actively using, the Baltimore City Needle Exchange since 1994 has been exchanging syringes dirty for clean. 2 years ago, it became more of a distribution model, so people were asked what they need, and it wasn't a one-for-one exchange. Distribution models have been shown to be associated with lower HIV risk behaviors, lower HIV rates, et cetera. So it was great that the state passed that. And now there'll be needle exchanges throughout the state. They're allowed as of last year in a bill allowing permitting needle exchanges throughout the state, syringe services programs, as we call them. And that's something that will be happening. So it depends on, and then, of course, people go to jail sometimes. I mean, that's another place sometimes where people go who are using related to their addiction. There are lots of different ways that people who use drugs touch services, positive and negative.
When folks try to estimate the number of people that this is affecting here in our city and throughout the state and the country, I mean, there's one estimate by the CDC that said that somewhere upwards of 53,000 people died of opioid overdoses across the country last year. Do you buy the figure of 19,000 heroin addicts in the city of Baltimore? Because a lot of folks say, well, the more relevant figure is actually the number of people who are addicted who actually want treatment. There's a different pool there, right? I mean, there's some people who are addicted, but they're really not at a place in their life where they're looking to stop being addicts.
So 25,000 heroin opiate users, 19,000 people who inject drugs are the numbers. And I think the denominator, it's relevant. It's not just who wants treatment, because, of course, we know that it takes an average of 6 times for people to successfully become clean, cycling in and out of drug treatment. So any service that touches someone at a point in their use is important. So to me, the important number is that 25,000. Of course, that number is very hard to estimate. It's an estimate, right? Because it's not like mm-hmm. we know the denominator, although we actually are trying to estimate through a study estimating that denominator, because it's kind of a holy grail. Mm-hmm. Numbers always get thrown around. But I think that that's the number that's important, because people should have options at any point. It's not just if they're ready for treatment today, because they may be tomorrow.
And Robert Kindenberg, does that number strike you as about right in terms of the number of times it often takes for a treatment to take hold? Six times?
No, I've met over 1,000 people at treatment centers in my career, and there are thousands of people in the Mid-Atlantic region that are clean and sober as a result of the work that I've done and what I did at my other treatment center.
So what does that work entail?
What do you mean, what does that work entail?
In other words,
abstinence-based treatment,
if you come to your facility, it's mm-hmm. a private, it's a live-in facility, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It's up in Harford County. Someone mm-hmm. shows up at your doorstep, says, I'm addicted to heroin. What do you do to that person?
We treat them in an abstinence-based program. We not only deal with the withdrawal, we also deal with the behavioral aspects of the disease. We also work with the families, because it is a family disease. So when a client leaves us after 28 days, they really have a continuing care plan that sets forth what they've agreed to do for the next 4 months. And we include the family in that in terms of continuing treatment so that they can build on the foundation, number one. Number two, over 50% of our clients go to sober living environments when they come to see us. When you go to a sober living environment, you typically have to make a commitment of a minimum of 4 months. Some are 6 months. And
sober living environments are things that are set up by programs. They're not like they're just going back to their their normal home and saying,
right.
okay, everybody, no
right.
dope,
they go
no
to a
alcohol.
Sober living environment. They're expected to get a job, be responsible, go to meetings, get counseling. Oftentimes the family participates in counseling as well, as you build on the foundation of recovery. Now, is the disease of addiction an event like a hot gallbladder? No. Do people relapse? Absolutely. But I think the key is that there needs to be the services available when it's needed. And today in the environment, I don't care whether it's Baltimore City, whether it's Chicago, Illinois, whether it's Harford County, when somebody needs the help, it needs to be there. And that's a real problem.
Absolutely.
Because the services are not there. And in the state of Maryland, services have been, there's been a reduction in services in the last few years.
And this behavioral health systems report says that the capacity of serving people is about 17,590 people. They came up with this magic number somehow. But they're calling a capacity deficit of more than 7,000 people. So there seems to be a whole lot more folks, Susan Sherman, who are in need of this treatment that Rob Kindenberg's talking about in an immediate way, who just don't have anywhere to go.
So I completely agree. You know, part of what I hope we get today is that what I think a safe drug consumption space, it's an option. It's an evidence-based tool in the toolkit, as is drug treatment. There is no doubt. And that number of, it takes a person average time of six times quitting, it's just from a study that has shown that it takes a while for people to quit. Absolutely, I agree. The types of treatment that Rob provides is what people need, including their family, thinking about employment, providing stable housing, giving new social networks. Those are all evidence-based, you know, successful ways to get people to maintain sobriety. So to me, you know, it'll be interesting when we get in this conversation, but these are tools in a toolkit for different people wherever they are in their addiction.
So I would agree. It's not mutually exclusive.
Right.
But the at least I've been in the field for 20 years. When I came into the field, what I was looking for was an opportunity to give people the opportunity to become contributing members of society. And whatever we need to do that is what we need to do.
So let's talk then a little bit, Susan Sherman, about how this works. What you're proposing is to create places where if you're addicted and you're injecting drugs or perhaps even taking them in some other form, you can go to a specific place, and then what happens?
So, yes. So safe consumption spaces are also known as safe injection facilities. Those are places where people inject only, but safe consumption means they could smoke as well, are places where people come in and they consume previously bought illicit drugs. I just want to give people a visualization. The only legal and open to the public safe injection space is in Vancouver. It's called Insight. And in Insight, there's a booth that's on the edge of a semicircle where a desk where, you know, the person who is on, that's the supervised of the supervised injection piece, a nurse or nurse practitioner. And then there are 13 booths in a semicircle. They all have mirrors. So if somebody overdoses, they immediately can be intervened upon and people inject in that space. It's a very clinical environment, as many of these spaces are. So what we propose is, knowing that there are many unsafe drug consumption spaces, public bathrooms, McDonald's bathrooms, doorsteps, alleys, abandominiums in Baltimore. So there are lots of places where people currently inject that are not safe. So this is a safe drug consumption space. We recommend that it would be on each side of town because of that invisible dividing line of MLK. And we know that there are intense drug scenes on both sides of town where people would come in, be able to do that. And also the best types and most effective safe consumption spaces have wraparound services. So that's not, it's a point of contact for people. I'll say there are 97 of these throughout 11 countries and 66 cities throughout the world. So this is nothing new.
And the medical personnel who's supervising in these places, they're not dispensing the drugs, right?
Previously.
So people, they've bought the drugs putatively on the street. They come in. So the medical personnel is not saying, oh, you shouldn't take that much. Just take half of it or something like that. Is there any of that kind of conversation that happens? I mean, you know, if someone's overdosed, if they overdose because they've taken too much or because the particular drug they've bought is laced with something like fentanyl, et cetera.
So that's a really good question. So as we know in Baltimore and many other cities on the East Coast, fentanyl and in Vancouver, fentanyl has really entered the drug market. And in some places, it's a fentanyl market with some heroin because it's a cheap synthetic that's, you know, person made. So, and I just want to say that there's never been anyone in the hundreds of thousands of injections in any of these safe facilities who's died from an overdose. They've all been intervened upon. The person, if someone asks for help around how much should they consume? No one can really see what's in the pill or in the powder that they're taking. I will say that at Insight now, they're using a strip to test for the presence of fentanyl so people can know, because so many people are dying now, so that people can know if they are actually consuming fentanyl.
They might not even know, right, for the stuff that they bought. They don't know if it's
poisonous. They typically don't know.
Great. All right, we're going to come back after a break. Dr. Susan Sherman is a professor of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in their Department of Health Behavior and Society. She's one of the authors of a new ABLE Foundation report called Safe Drug Consumption Spaces, a Strategy for Baltimore City. Robert Kinnenberg is the owner and director of the Phoenix Recovery Center, a drug and alcohol addiction treatment center in Edgewood. When we come back from the break, we hope to be able to speak with Baltimore County Delegate Dan Morheim. He's a licensed physician who has co-sponsored a bill that would authorize state and local health departments to license safe drug consumption spaces here in Maryland. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. So what do you think? Giving people a safe place to inject drugs. They call it a harm prevention strategy. You think it would work? Well, give us a call, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. We'll be back in a flash. Stick around.
You're listening to Midday here on your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. By the way, coming up on tomorrow's show, I'll be talking to three freshman members of the Baltimore City Council. Shannon Sneed, Leon Pinkett, and Ryan Dorsey are part of a wave of eight new members elected last November to the 14-seat body. Pundits predicted that they'd be shaking things up on the council. We'll see how that's working out for them and what we can expect from the Baltimore City Council moving forward. That's tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about an unorthodox proposal to open safe spaces for IV drug addicts to use drugs in Baltimore. It's an idea that's laid out in a new ABLE Foundation report by one of our guests today, Dr. Susan Sherman. She's a professor in the Department of Health Behavior and Society at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Health. Also here in the studio is Robert Kinnenberg. He's a recovering addict and has been for the past 23 years, and he's been in the addiction treatment field for more than two decades. He's currently the director of the Phoenix Recovery Center, a drug and alcohol addiction treatment center in Harford County. Now we're going to turn to Maryland Delegate Dan Morheim, a Democrat representing the 11th District, which includes Baltimore County. Delegate Morheim is a licensed physician. He has co-sponsored a bill that he introduced last week that would authorize state and local health departments to license safe drug consumption spaces in communities across Maryland. He joins us from the State House in Annapolis. Delegate, welcome to Midday.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you and everybody else.
So tell us about your bill. What would your bill accomplish?
Well, the bill is enabling. That means it would allow local entities called community organizations, which are defined, to set up a safe consumption facility. Now, let me say, everybody on the phone, and I think everybody who's listening, it knows that substance abuse is a bad thing, and we don't condone it or want to support it. And frankly, this isn't the bill that I would have put in a few years ago, but there is a tendency to want to have a one-size-fits-all. Here's the causes of this problem. Here's how to fix it. My perspective is there's many causes and there's many different kinds of fixes, and this is one. And frankly, uncomfortable as it may seem to some, the data, and Susan Sherman has really done a great job at the ABLE Foundation, the data is clear. This works. And sometimes you just have to let your decision-making be driven by actual facts. So, you know, there's people who want to have greater funding for a long-term treatment. That's entirely correct. I totally support that. There's a treatment that would be available for people who want to go faith-based or abstinence. That's appropriate for some folks, too. Then there's the medicated assisted treatments, buprenorphine, Vivitrol, methadone. That's appropriate for some people as well. But this targets a particularly tough group of substance abusers. There are about 20,000 estimated in Baltimore City. They're the hardcore group that's using drugs two and three times a day. And this gets them at least into harm reduction, moving into a safer place to take their drugs, where, by the way, the overdose death rate is zero because there's always a rescuer present. Much greater involvement getting people moving from the bad lifestyles they're in into treatment programs. Much more success with that, fewer syringes on the street. So it's a little hard, I understand, for some people to wrap their heads around this. It's not condoning drug use, but it's employing one of many different kinds of strategies that are going to be necessary to get this problem solved, and different things work for different people, and that's what the bill does.
So, Delegate, when you say that it works, how do you define that? What does work mean?
Well, work means, and I think Susan Sherman can speak to this really well because she's done the definitive study on the subject, but work means wherever people are at, you're moving them to a less dangerous, less harmful place by degrees. You know, we've been trying, you know, historically for 50-plus years, the criminal justice system, which certainly has a role, but it's clearly not working. We're hardly in a position to pat ourselves on the back and congratulate each other on what a great job we've done managing the drug issue, because there's clearly all the data points are bad. So at the very least, it gets people into a place where they don't die because there's a rescuer present. Then it gets them, you know, oriented to using clean needles so they're not spreading disease. But then hopefully the real connection, once they start getting to know the place and getting to know the counselors there, gets them off of drugs and moves them into addiction treatment programs. That's how it works. But some people can go from, you know, being a drug user right into abstinence, but most don't. They get there by degrees, and different kind of strategies work for different people. This is just to get those folks connected into a therapeutic environment that they're otherwise not in.
Of course, there's all sorts of legal complications with this having to do with federal law and, of course, with the Trump administration and Jeff Sessions, now the new attorney general. We know that he's opposed even to recreational use of marijuana, in which a lot of states are adopting. Given those legal complications, what can the state do? What should the state do if your bill is passed? How will that coincide or resonate with current federal law?
Well, circumstances in Washington, D.C. should not dictate what we do at the state level. And there's many examples where the states do things that are, you know, not in concert with federal law or go farther than federal law. And medical cannabis is clearly one, but there are others as well. So I think it's important for us to do the right thing based on data. It turns out that almost all drug arrests happen at the state level. And what this bill does, it does not legalize possession of drugs, but what it does do is say if the community-based organization, let's say a church or an already existing drug treatment program, adds safe consumption facilities to its program, then the operators of the program would not be subject to state arrest. And since 99% of arrests for drugs occur at the state level, that should be sufficient protection. Is it 100% guaranteed against federal interaction action? No, it isn't. And by the way, last session we passed a bill called Senate Bill 97, Governor Hogan's bill, which encourages community-based organizations to get involved in treatment programs. It does not have the safe consumption facility part, but the safe consumption bill is modeled very much on the governor's bill, which was enacted, and it adds this extra element because the data shows that it works.
Speaking of the governor, there's a House Judiciary Committee hearing that's going to take place in about a half an hour, talking about a bill concerning the distribution of opioids. The governor has proposed several things having to do with opioid use, abuse, and distribution, et cetera. Do you have a sense of how the governor feels about your piece of legislation? Were it to pass the House and the Senate, do you think he'd sign it?
I never would want to make a prediction about what this or any other governor would do. That could be weeks or months away. But there are at least 26 or 29 bills dealing with the opioid issue. And to my mind, almost all of them have merit. They just approach different parts of this in different ways, ranging from funding for long-term treatment to funding for organizations that promote abstinence. I have bills this afternoon that would require hospitals to have addiction counselors or peer review counselors in the emergency department. As you know, I'm an emergency medicine physician, and substance abusers tend to congregate in ERs. In fact, I would say almost all substance abusers end up at some point in an emergency room, and we take care of their somatic, that is, their physical problems, but then we give them a piece of paper with a bunch of phone numbers on it for their behavioral health and drug problems, which is wholly inadequate. So this would have counselors there. By the way, I mean, if you came in the emergency room with appendicitis, I don't give you a sheet of paper with them. Say, here's, Mr. Hall, you have appendicitis. Here's a phone numbers for a lot of surgeons. Good luck.
Yeah.
We actually take care of it. And that's what we need to do with this, because hospitals are open 24/7, 365. They're well lit. They have safety, security. They're regulated. And I think, in you know, my clinical experience, so many patients I've taken care of, and they want to take that next step, and they're in that moment, but I have nothing to offer them. And so that bill, I think, is going to be heard today, and I hope people will look at that as well as another tool in the toolbox here.
All right. Well, Delegate Dan Morheim, I know you're busy, so we're going to let you go. I appreciate your taking a minute away from your duties at the State House to talk about this piece of legislation, and we will be in touch about this and other things as the session continues.
Thank you, Tom. Very important topic, and thank you for having me on and along with the others.
All right. Good to see you, or good to talk to you. Dan Morheim is the delegate from the 11th District in the Maryland House of Delegates. So, Susan Sherman, when we talk about success, when Dan uses the term, we know it works.
Right. You
know, so the data talks about things like, for example, spread of disease. It looks like about 24% of the people injecting drugs in Baltimore, and as many as 84% injecting. Well, 24% spread or have HIV. 84% perhaps have hepatitis. So, or hepatitis C. So, if they're sharing needles, obviously, that's going to be a bad thing. That's one of the things that the places where it's working now, where it's in place now, they've found a big reduction in that, I guess.
So I'd love to talk about how it works in a number of ways. The first thing I do want to say, though, you know, you had mentioned earlier that people who inject drugs often inject with dirty needles, and that's really not often is not the case necessarily anymore. We do have a needle exchange. It's open at 17 sites 6 days a week. People can get their syringes from pharmacies. There are other ways people get syringes as well. But the norms have really shifted over time that people don't inject with unless they don't have a supply. So I just want to say that. But there are about 34 new cases of HIV a year in Baltimore City among injection drug users. There were this last year. So how do safe consumption spaces, what are their impact? First of all, one of the early studies in Vancouver among over a thousand people who went to the safe to Insight found that there was a 30% increase in residential detox treatment services in the first year of being at the SIF compared to the control year, which was the year before the SIF was open. So actually going to these facilities, and there have been other studies from Vancouver that have shown factors independently associated with addiction initiation included going to regular use of the SIF and also having contact with the addiction counselor there. There are other studies.
So those when they go and they're in these places, these safe buildings, they have these medical personnel there to talk to. They're taking the drugs, but they're also getting information about treatment. I mean, Dan Morheim's talking about, you know, giving me a list of places that are going to operate on my appendix. They are giving
right.
those
Well,
lists.
He was talking about, right, when you go to the hospital. But
right.
Yes. So the kind of wraparound services that are at many successful safe consumption spaces include counselors, case management. People have housing issues. People have legal issues. So counselors to deal with emotional issues, but also case managers to connect them with other services. Exchanging syringes, that's also available. In Vancouver, on top of Insight is OnSite, which is a drug treatment program that actually has a separate entry. So it's not like people are, you know, being exposed to people going to inject while they're trying to go get drug treatment. And since it's been open in 2007, there are 2,800 people that have received detox there. So I can't stress enough that this is a tool that is evidence-based in a toolkit. You would never use a hammer for everything. Sometimes you need a screwdriver. Sometimes you need a Phillips, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to have a bunch of different options. But, I mean, I want to go to the phones here, Rob Kinnenberg. But before I do, what do you say to folks who say this is just giving up? Instead of trying to cure their addiction, you're enabling them and you're putting off the cure for addiction. I mean, for example, you talk about the family dimension of the work that you do at the Phoenix Recovery Center. There are lots of folks who are addicted to drugs who don't have families. They're estranged from their families. They're homeless. They're dealing with a whole panoply of other issues. How do you approach that?
Well, I mean, there are several harm reduction programs available, whether it be methadone, Suboxone, the needle exchange programs, and those things are available. The bottom line is that if you don't do something to address the behavioral aspects of the disease, you'll use again. And that's just the bottom line. And I think that the bigger problem is the lack of services available for actual treatment, whether it be abstinence-based or long-term or whatever it is, or co-occurring disorders. There's just a lack of availability. Now, years ago, I ran an outpatient department for Ashley Treatment. I worked there for 9 years. I ran their outpatient department. The recidivism rate at outpatient is horrendous. I did a study on it. It was 60%. We would bring people into the program. They'd show up for two or three sessions, and then...
You wouldn't see them again.
You wouldn't see them again. So a safe, structured environment where you can focus on yourself, leave the outside world alone, develop a foundation of recovery, really find out who and what you are, and develop a set of tools to deal with life in life terms, in my view, is very, very important.
Let's go to the phones. Karen in Baltimore City, you've been very patient. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Oh, thank you very much. So I'm kind of ambivalent about this. I have a unique perspective because I'm a nurse in one of the large downtown city hospitals, and I work in oncology, and I have a lot of patients who, you know, get HIV from various causes, including drugs, and then end up getting lymphoma, so they end up in my unit. So I see what, you know, the effects of drug addiction can lead to just from a medical aspect. I'm also the mother of a heroin addict, and we're very lucky because he's still under his dad's insurance. We actually have some means. We're kind of upper middle class people. And so we've been able to pay for a lot of treatment for him when insurance didn't cover it. And even with that, he's relapsed quite a few times. He's doing pretty well right now, but he's in a sober living house and he'll be there for a while. And I have to say that something that I learned the last year or two is that the less we enable him, the more we demand from him, the better he's done and the more he's moved towards hopefully long-term sobriety. And even though I think there's a lot of, I understand a lot of this based on evidence-based practice, and it seems to be make a lot of sense in a certain sort of way, in some ways it still feels like extreme enabling for the addict. So I just wanted to give that perspective that I'm not necessarily totally against it, but I have some reservations, and I also feel that, you know, for instance, when my son went to inpatient rehab a year or so ago, it would have cost us about $60,000, except that his dad had Cadillac insurance, so it still cost a lot of money. But people don't have that kind of money,
sure.
You know? I mean, insurance covers 7 days, 14 days, 28 days. That's not enough for someone who's a real addict. So should these resources that are being, you know, directed into this kind of facility be more directed towards helping middle class, lower middle class, working class, whatever, poor people be able to live in a sober living place for a year, which is what my son is probably going to have to do to have any chance of ever maintaining long-term sobriety.
Great. Well, thank you for your perspective, Karen. I appreciate it, and God bless your son, and good luck to all of you as his recovery continues. So, Susan Sherman, you know, is it enabling? And or is it just enabling for a certain period of time until you can get to a different point in the person's life?
Well, I appreciate the call, and thank you for sharing that about your son. It all depends on what you think is enabling. It's a point of contact for people who often don't feel that they have much respect. Can you imagine if you inject, the average really is 5 to 8 times a day for hardcore drug users in Baltimore City, and you go to a place where you don't have to hide, that is clean, where people treat you with human dignity and respect, which might sound touchy-feely, but is absolutely not to be underestimated. And it's a point of contact. Maybe the next time they ask about what other services exist, they talk to a counselor. You know, we are living in unprecedented times in terms of these epidemics of fentanyl and pills. There are enough prescription opioids in the U.S. that every adult could have 75 in their hand. We have a whole new batch of heroin users because pills, you lose the prescription. They're very expensive illegally. Heroin's a lot cheaper. And then you don't know what you're injecting. So I guess from one perspective, you could say it was enabling. But I think that it really is meeting people where they are, which is the nature of harm reduction on a continuum of care for them. And in terms of the cost, if I could just say, we have a study that we've just submitted. Amos Ehrman actually was the lead author. I'm the senior author on a study that we actually found that there's an annual cost in Baltimore City of a safe private consumption facility like the one in Vancouver of 1.8 million, and a single one SIF would generate 7-8 million in cost savings in terms of HIV cases averted, hepatitis C cases averted, hospitalizations, ambulance calls, emergency room visits, et cetera. So using data, and then we costed out each of those morbidities averted. So yes, it is taking, I mean, if I don't think there's a zero sum, but it is taking money that maybe would be used for something else, but an incredible savings.
All right. We have lots more to talk about when we come back. We're also going to hear from Dr. Lena Nguyen, the city health commissioner, and see what she thinks about this idea. Our guest in the studio today, Dr. Susan Sherman. She's a professor in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the author of a new ABLE Foundation report called Safe Drug Consumption Spaces, a Strategy for Baltimore City. Robert Kinneberg is a 20-year veteran in the addiction treatment field. He owns and directs the Phoenix Recovery Center. That's a private live-in drug and alcohol addiction treatment center in Harford County. We do have to take a short break. You are welcome to join us when we return. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking today about the possibility of creating safe drug consumption spaces in Baltimore and perhaps even throughout the state. The idea of a legally sanctioned space for addicts to inject drugs in a sterile, medically supervised environment is a so-called harm reduction approach that appears to be working in more than 60 cities around the world. Robert Kinneberg of the Phoenix Recovery Center in Harford County is a 20-year veteran in the addiction treatment field. He's here with me in Studio A, along with Dr. Susan Sherman. She's a professor in the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and one of the authors of the new ABLE Foundation report called Safe Drug Consumption Spaces, a Strategy for Baltimore City. If you'd like to join our conversation, 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And if you want to drop us a tweet, you can find us @MiddayTomHall. So let's talk a little bit more about the cost of this program or this proposal. There's obviously also a cost of not doing anything. And one of the people that makes that point an awful lot is Dr. Lena Nguyen, who's the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore. She appears with us here on Midday about once a month in a segment we call the Health Watch. I talked to Lena last week and asked her what she thought about this idea. This is what she had to say.
We're not opposed to exploring, in theory, the safe injection facility here in Baltimore City. However, at the moment, it remains a hypothetical query because, as I understand, the whether safe injection facilities would be allowed depends on interpretation of federal law. There's a new presidential administration. There is a new attorney general, Jeff Sessions, and we need guidance from the Department of Justice on how federal law is going to be interpreted. This is a matter of potential federal prosecution. In addition, we at the Baltimore City Health Department receive many federal funds that allow us to care for the most vulnerable individuals in our city, including to treat the opioid epidemic, including to save lives from communicable diseases. And so it's important for us, before we proceed to thinking about how would this work in Baltimore City, we need guidance officially from federal officials from the new presidential administration. We really need to do a lot more when it comes to treating the opioid epidemic. We also know that there are evidence-based measures that work. We have already saved over 800 lives just from neighbors saving neighbors using Narcan or Naloxone here in our city. We know that we need to expand treatment and get people treatment at the time that they need. There are a lot of other things that we also must work on. The idea of a safe injection facility is one that we can explore, but again, really hinges on the federal guidance that we have yet to receive.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, the health commissioner of Baltimore City, we talked Last week, we have a tweet from Louise who says, I think it's great as an RN in West Baltimore health, or rather West Baltimore home care. I see drug abuse daily. At least they won't die till we try to help them. We have another tweet from Kathleen who says, this is a terrible idea. There's much better ways to spend that same money to help homeless people, mentally ill, disabled, etc. So obviously this is, you know, Susan Sherman, you knew when you wrote this report it was going to be pretty controversial. Talk about, because you mentioned as part of your legal analysis in the report that the staff and the operators very well may be exposed to legal risks. There are other cities in America. I mean, Vancouver, you've mentioned, in Canada has had some success with this program, and there are several cities, many cities in Europe. Seattle, Washington, Ithaca, New York, San Francisco, California, looking at this, and they've been looking at it now for 2 or 3 years, so they're well down the path. What are they learning about how those, you know, local jurisdictions would, you know, fit into federal laws?
So we've been really lucky that there have been legal reads done for us. The legal read that's in the report is by the Drug Policy Alliance. A wonderful woman named Lindsay LaSalle wrote that. She also did the legal read in Seattle. It is absolutely true that we would be protected if Delegate Morheim's legislation went through, which, as he said, is enabling, which allows this to happen. That would protect the backs of the people who are working in these centers. And I disagree a little bit with Dr. Wen. I appreciate her talking on this issue. You know, Louis Brandeis said that states are the laboratories of democracy. So there are lots of instances where states have gone ahead and done things and then federal law kind of had to catch up. That often happens in the courts. Needle exchange, for example, there was a federal ban since 1989 that was lifted to a degree a few years ago when we started having such overdose epidemics kind of throughout the country. There were lots of needle exchanges before they were recognized or funded by the federal government. So obviously, Jeff Sessions, you know, like you said, with medical marijuana, with recreational marijuana now being questioned, and the feds are saying they're going to enforce the federal law, it has probably more of an uphill battle if Hillary Clinton had won in the White House. But to me, that's not enough reason not to let us be the laboratory of democracy that we are as a state. And hopefully Delegate Morheim's legislation will pass. And if not, the Maryland, the Baltimore City charter allows for home rule. There's a lot of latitude that can happen within the city. So there are other legal options. It's spelled out by a great lawyer in the report. But It's a real understandable concern.
Let's try to sneak in a couple more phone calls. Debbie in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Robert Kinberg and Susan Sherman.
Hello.
Hi, Debbie. You're on the air. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, well, it's more of an observation that when we talk about people who are taking things, ingesting things into their bodies that by nature are not safe, and for them to follow suit to actually go to a place that is safe to do the same thing, it comes across to me as holding two opposing opinions at the same time, that you're doing something that is detrimental to you physically, but you have the wherewithal and the mindset to say, well, I'm going to go to a safe place. So for me, that's where my observation comes into play, that it doesn't, there's a disconnect. And the other thing I would just like to say is when they are taking these drugs at a safe place, like in Vancouver, and either it's going to affect your central nervous system, either it's going to be a depressant or a stimulant, when those interactions occur, what does the staff do when a person is getting either hyper or getting on the downside? Do they just come in and walk out? They got their fix, they walk out. So how would the staff have them to leave? And do they leave on their own accord? And I don't know, just a lot of things coming to play.
All right, well, thanks, Debbie. Yeah, I appreciate the call, Debbie. So Susan, quickly before we go back to Rob Kinberg, What about that comment? You know, if you're doing an inherently unsafe thing to your body, do you still have that instinct to do it safely?
It's a good point. I bet we can all think of instances in our own life where we might drink too much for some of us, or something else that's not safe, and then we make accommodations to know that we're not going to be driving, for example. So I think it's important. Drug users make lots of different choices every day, and just because you inject heroin doesn't mean that you aren't wanting to take care of yourself in other ways. So there are 700 visits a day to Insight. So people are going. It is an oxymoron, mm-hmm. right? But it's, yes, you don't know what's going in your arm, but in your system, but you actually want to be in a place so you don't die because of that.
Yeah. And Rob Kinneberg, Lena Wen, among others, makes the point repeatedly that this that addiction is a disease like colon cancer or a brain tumor. I mean, it's got to be treated like a disease. For the population that you treat up at the Phoenix Recovery Center, when they do something like abstinence, when someone comes in, how do you know this is a person we've got to say, look, from now on, you're never going to consume drugs anymore, as opposed to the person says, okay, look, from now on, we're going to give you methadone instead of heroin. How do you make that call?
Yeah, well, we're an abstinence-based program, and we believe in abstinence-based treatment. Methadone is harm reduction. Suboxone is harm reduction. We use Suboxone for detox only. We medicate for 5 days with Suboxone and 3 other medications. And we have we have certified acupuncturists. We do acu-detox as well. And we believe that if to become a contributing member of society, you need to remain abstinent. And that's what our goal is to get people that have been on the streets of Baltimore or Harford County or Baltimore County or any place and get them into treatment and give them a foundation so that they can become a contributing member of society. And I think that I just wanted to address some of the core issues that are problematic for addiction in the state of Maryland and nationally. One is that there's been a reduction in funding and treatment at the state level. Second is physicians overprescribe pain medications. And part of that is driven by, and no disrespect, I've worked with Jayco for years in the hospital business and treatment business, but several years ago,
what's Jayco?
The Joint Commission Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Wouldn't have known that one.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And one of their focuses several years ago was pain abatement. When you go into the hospital, when I had my hips replaced 3 years ago, the first thing they asked me was, "What's your pain level?"
1 to 10. Right?
1 to 10. Right. Yeah. And of course, I made it very clear I was not going to take any pain medications. But if I'm an addict in active addiction, or if I've got a history and the person says, what's your pain level, I may say 10, and it's a 3 because I can get drugs. The second thing is that with private insurance now, there's many of the private insurances that are out there have a very high deductible, as high as if you pick a bronze plan, it's $5,000. That precludes you from getting help. There's also recent changes in state insurance in the state of Maryland guidelines for live-in treatment if you're over 21. And there's also significant compliance issues with outpatient treatment. As I said, when I ran an outpatient department, the recidivism rate was terrible.
So maybe this is all an argument for what Susan's proposing then, that this is a good, you know, intermediary step between being in active addiction and getting the kind of help that
you're reduction, it helps with sexually transmitted disease mm-hmm. and health-related issues associated with heroin addiction, but it doesn't bring the person to being a contributing member of society. It's a stopgap measure. Right.
But Susan, you're not proposing that it's going to do that. You're just saying it's going to keep them safe
in the
short term.
Right. And the evidence is actually otherwise, that it connects people to treatment, that people are more likely to enter treatment from going to these kinds of facilities. So,
the challenge here is that in the state of Maryland, there's a reduction in services. The county health departments, many of the county health departments in the state of Maryland have lost the funding for addiction services.
Right. And unfortunately, we're going to have to make that the last word. We are out of time, but I very much appreciate both of you coming by. I'm sorry we didn't get to Ricardo and Miles on our phone list, but we will try to get to you on a different day and a different topic. Dr. Susan Sherman is a professor in the Department of Health Behavior and Society at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, along with Kyle Hunter and Saba Rouhani. She's the author of a new ABLE Foundation report released earlier this month called Safe Drug Consumption Spaces, a Strategy for Baltimore City. Robert Kinneberg is the owner and director of the Phoenix Recovery Center, a private live-in drug and alcohol treatment center in Edgewood up in Harford County. That's it for us today. Coming up on Midday Wednesday, three freshman members of the Baltimore City Council join me to talk about their first 3 months in office, what they're accomplishing, what they're learning, and what they're changing in City Hall as they and five other members elected to the council for the first time last November begin to make their mark. Shannon Sneed, Leon Pinkett, and Ryan Dorsey will join me tomorrow here in Studio A, and I hope you can join us as well. And this program note, President Trump's first address to Congress starts at 9 o'clock tonight here on WIPR. Our coverage from NPR begins at 8 o'clock with the National Call-In Show. And Choral Arts Classics, originally scheduled for tonight, will air tomorrow night instead at 9 o'clock right here on 88.1. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch for our guests today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. They've got locations and hours listed on their website, joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Stay tuned for Here and Now for the entire Midday team. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.